Okay, everyone, we're just going to get started. So I'd like to welcome everyone for attending today's presentation, both at AU Central and those online on Illuminate. And we must inform you that today's Lunch and Learn is being recorded via Illuminate Live. The presentation will be posted onto the Research Center website and AU Space for anyone who wishes to view it at a later date. And, of course, any participants in the room here at AU Central, if you could use your microphone for any questions, then this will help those online to hear your questions. So now it's my pleasure to hand the microphone over to Judy Malone, and who will continue with today's presentation. Judy.
There's a very good group in the room for those of you who are online. And while folk are settling in and joining us again, I did really want to thank everybody for coming. I think that's great, and I appreciate the attendance. In this particular presentation, I'm going to review my recent doctoral dissertation and highlight some of the aspects of rural professional practice for Canadian psychologists. So for those who don't know me, I've been a tutor here at Athabasca University for the past 10 years, and I'm very active with the university. My recent doctoral dissertation was based on my own knowledge and experience as a rural psychologist and my active involvement in the profession. Ethics has always been my passion, but when working on ethics committees and even co-authoring national ethics guidelines, I often really had to struggle internally to place them into the context of my own practice. Seemed as if rural practice was represented almost more of a different community or context of practice, at least in psychology. So given my interest and experience in the field, it was very natural for me to do research on rural professional practice and ethics. So this research was conducted between 2007 and 2010 over the course of a doctoral dissertation with Charles Sturt University. They're the primary Australian distance education providers that really work within the field of rural health and rural psychology. In the overview I'm doing here today, I'm going to explore the context and ethical challenges of rural professional practice in psychology. And in sharing some of the results, I want to highlight the challenges and rewards of rural professional practice and the implications for practice-based education of mental health professionals. Rural practice in Canada means practice in a unique context for psychologists, and one that's rarely studied in the field of psychology. My primary research question was, what ethical issues arise for you as a practicing rural psychologist, and how do you deal with these? And that was explored through the actual practices of rural psychologists. The hermeneutic phenomenological research methods I used considered my influence as an insider researcher, while really seeking to understand meaning and processes from the perspective of the 20 nationwide participants. And those individuals were right from one end of Canada to the other. This study focused on their experience of professional ethics and on factors associated with those experiences. Through the process of a hermeneutic circle, the socio-historical context of this study was explored through participant-focused considerations. That doesn't always occur. That's the way I structured this particular research. From there, the major themes of the study revealed some of those meanings and processes that were really specific to rural Canadian professional practice. The findings begin with an account of the dominant socio-historical considerations. Identified by the participants, these were competition and concern over the delivery of services, really who is offering what is psychology. The influence of government, of course, on funding, programs, services. The prescriptive authority debate, which we're considering right now in North America, psychologists being able to prescribe. Rural-specific registration and mobility concerns, despite our agreement for internal trade, that's still a little messy for psychologists. And the real dearth of advocacy for psychology and for those who access the services. So these particular dimensions really set the national context for the participants' experience. Thematic analysis then led to three themes that were central to understanding the phenomenon of professional ethics for the participants. The first theme highlights the way that demographic and practice characteristics may well instigate ethical issues. The second theme was a compendium of the 5 common ethical dilemmas as they were experienced by the participants. And the third theme was an experiential exploration of ethical development through the ethical schema used by rural psychologists. While this study is really bound to its situational context and the participants' ability to articulate ethical processes, it did allow for a rich and dynamic study of the meaning of those experiences. Small communities can be defined by culture, professional experience, geographic separation, and of course rurality. So this particular slide is a shot of Canada at night, really highlighting what are the populated areas, and from there you can fill in the blanks with what is rural. The multidimensional concept of what is rural has not yet been adequately defined and may never be. In Canada, we have no consistent government or agency definitions. What is commonly used is 17 different definitions of what is rural in Canada. Given the complexities of understanding these communities, I wanted to consider what participants themselves would define as rural. So rather than beginning with one of those static definitions of rural, I incorporated 2 processes for participant selection. So first, I accepted participants who self-identified as rural, knowing that they would be more intimately familiar with the communities they serve. And the second I used was based on Statistics Canada's flexible benchmark, which is communities of 10,000 people or less outside a commuting zone of an urban center. They don't define what the commuting zone is, but sort of between those two, I used that for the participant selection. And actually, a proposed definition of what is rural was one of the unintended findings of the study. Rural practice issues are germane to Canadian psychology due to the immense geography and rural and remote dispersion of the population. So here in Canada, 90% of the landmass is considered rural and remote, and depending who you read, about 20% of the population, really anywhere from 17 to 25%, are considered to be Canadians living in small, rural, or dispersed communities. Research has shown that the prevailing idea of an idyllic, stress-free rural life is actually an urban myth here in Canada. International and national changes in economies, politics, and ecology have created disadvantages for rural people, increasing their needs and decreasing their ability to serve their community members. Key forces shaping rural communities here in Canada have been geographic isolation, social and economic factors, rapid changes to rural areas, and the culture of rural people. So if I give just one example of that, a recent study by Stats Canada found that the per capita population of refugees and immigrants in rural areas is now higher than in urban centers in Canada, changing the face of rural Canada. Isolation creates service disparity, but being isolated doesn't protect rural communities from the impact of national and world events. Another point, rural communities experience more economic hardship and report higher levels of unemployment and underemployment than there is even for inner city residents in Canada, and that's even greater for women and children in rural Canada. While the available discourse tends to present a bleak picture of rural health, it also indicates that there are complex and nuanced aspects of rural practice. It's an important consideration to really balance the commonalities of rural people with a recognition of diversity and variation across this country. Most of the pictures in the presentation are my own. 2 of these, the polar bear and the fields, I got online because I think the 3 of them sort of spoke a little bit to the variation we have in rural Canada. This was something that really stood out for me on the day when I interviewed a psychologist in the Queen Charlotte Islands of BC, and I was sitting in a cabin in coastal Newfoundland. So I don't think we could have been any further apart, and also really in very different contexts and communities. The health of rural Canadians involves those kind of complex environmental, cultural, social, and psychological factors. Challenges relate to distance, fewer colleagues and allied health professionals, and limited training, research, and professional infrastructure in rural practice. The social networks and values of rural communities position the practicing psychologist in a cultural system that might be vastly different than those of their urban colleagues. Psychologists need to consider exactly that, content and context, when they're considering ethical dilemmas and decision making. Psychology in rural practice presents a really specific context, and that increases our responsibility, maybe our anxieties about decision making, especially ethical decision making, and fosters a need for rural psychologists to have very mature and reflexive understandings of ethics. Although mental disorders are thought to be more prevalent in rural and remote Canada, there's a shortage of mental health professionals in these areas. In particular, the ratio of psychologists to population is 4 times higher in urban than rural areas of Canada, and we have really significant recruitment and retention issues here in Canada. Rural psychologists tend to be less experienced than their urban counterparts, and one reason, not that we're sure why, may be that Canadian psychology students received little to no formal training in rural practice considerations. And that's despite the Romano Commission that very clearly stated there is a distinct need for the further development of rural and remote psychological services. It's also despite market demands. Ethical issues can be more prevalent, complicated, or perhaps even less easily resolved in certain contexts. Although the underlying ethical issues may be similar between rural and urban settings, they may well manifest in different ways in rural communities. The ethical issues explored in this research may be fundamentally common, but they take on different complexions and complexities in rural settings, which beget a better understanding of rural professional practice. Overlapping relationships, community pressure, generalist practice, interdisciplinary collaboration, and professional development and support are aspects of rural practice that may be more common. When they are, they pose risks by complicating professional practice and the resolution of related ethical dilemmas. This second theme of the research was an account of those 5 common ethical dilemmas as experienced by the participants. Personally, when I go into my child's school, I know most of the teachers. Some taught one of my daughters. Most have been in professional development sessions that I've offered. Some are past students. Others are relatives, and some are clients. I just say hi to everyone. Overlapping relationships can occur with family, friends, and colleagues. They arise during client interactions or from broader community involvement. Such relationships can lead to ethical dilemmas from unanticipated interactions and from providing the psychologist with outside information about clients. Participants in this study managed overlapping relationships by being aware of them and handling them with particular caution, engaging in frequent consultation, and by setting clear and reasonable expectations and boundaries. Personally, I get so many requests for services that I've hired someone to screen calls and provide information about available services. The few of us who work here in the Lakeland in Alberta joke that we could be 5 full-time people each. That kind of community pressure can create difficult expectations for the rural psychologist and raises our personal visibility. This means a real need to balance our personal and our professional roles. Participants shared many valuable ideas for managing community pressure, including working with a triage model, someone screening and dealing with requests, setting clear boundaries with community agencies, very carefully carving out personal time. For many people, that meant having unlisted phone numbers or living in areas that are a little less easy to find, and developing procedures for managing client privacy during chance community encounters. Not a person I interviewed didn't talk about how they prepared clients. Now, if I run into you uptown, if you say hi to me, I'll say hi to you. And if you want to ignore me, we all have these little scripts that we're well versed in. My own practice is one that the literature would consider generalist practice. Much like family physicians, rural psychologists can very rarely be specialists. The ethical dilemmas inherent in generalist practice are intensified when there are fewer accessible alternate services. And that can really cause angst with rural psychologists. The participants in this study managed generalist practice dilemmas through self-awareness and really working to set personal and professional limits, articulating those limits clearly to others, which is one way of keeping us within them, and seeking consultation and supervision that was really about generalist practice and rural practice. Twice weekly, I work in a remote Aboriginal health center, and most of the staff there are community members. I'm one of the only outsiders that comes in, and it's a wide range of professionals and paraprofessionals within that team, and we collectively offer services. That's not uncommon in rural settings. Interdisciplinary collaboration may require psychologists to advocate for the role of psychology, manage very different levels of professionalism, and develop particular protocols to maintain confidentiality when you're doing collaboration. Participants in this study managed interdisciplinary collaborations through establishing very strong and clear boundaries, setting those boundaries respectfully, and actively developing working relationships. And that really helps us to not be seen as the anal annies at the table when it comes to issues like confidentiality when you're working together. The final main area is professional development and support. Rural psychologists experience difficulties acquiring really appropriate training, consultation, and supervision. And these kind of pressures may increase isolation and burnout risks, which can, of course, decrease our competency. Participants in this study managed their need for professional development and support through building networks of geographically separated peers, including in those networks non-psychologists who understand rural practice, and by using technology for consultation and professional development. And not having any prior research, I'm guessing some of that's a real change from even 10 or 20 years ago. Overlapping relationships, community pressure, generalist practice, interdisciplinary collaboration, and professional development and support are aspects of rural practice that may be more prevalent. When they are, they pose risks by complicating professional practice and the resolution of related ethical issues. These issues are acknowledged and discussed in the professional literature and in some cases supported by empirical data. Collectively, this material underscores the need for rural psychologists to have good ethical decision-making and sound professional judgment to negotiate ethical issues and dilemmas. The current state of rural mental health has practical challenges and advantages for psychologists. Primary challenges are related to geographic barriers, lifestyle constraints, limited privacy, and higher risk of burnout. Rural psychologists may find that they serve a larger population, have more disadvantaged clients, and are more likely to work in professional isolation than their urban colleagues. Despite these challenges, Perkins, Larson, Lyle, and Burns in 2007 found that those who remain in rural practice report high levels of satisfaction with the job, the lifestyle, and the environment. Enhanced career, professional, and employment opportunities benefit the psychologist and the communities they serve. It's been found that those who work in rural settings do so by choice, and the distinct professional challenges and lifestyle advantages might be strong incentives. Rural psychologists may experience more intrinsic rewards related to the impact they can have for rural communities and people. These psychologists may also get professional challenge from working as generalists with a variety of client needs, building multi-layered relationships and connections, and having a contextual and multifaceted view of the clients and people that they serve. Although the literature highlights the challenges and dilemmas, this study unintentionally highlighted the rewards in rural practice. Participants in the study reframed those same situations that make ethical dilemmas more frequent by presenting really alternative views of rural practice. They spoke to the benefits and normative nature of overlapping relationships. There could be value in having prior information about a client. Also in rural practice, it can be really artificial to try and control unavoidable overlapping relationships. In St. Paul, we had one psychologist who didn't have enough business and left, but he refused to go to the pool or go to the mail or see anybody outside of the office. And folk were very suspicious of who he was and wouldn't go and see him. Despite the challenges of community pressure, participants highlighted benefits to working in embedded environments. Visibility normalizes the participant and enhanced their practice. Others framed community pressure as opportunities to contribute really to community development. Participants in the study also provided an alternative view to generalist practice. Some suggested that the real issue stems from psychology's urbanization. Others indicated that generalist practice was one of the real benefits to rural practice. They enjoyed variety and challenge. Other participants provided alternative views of interdisciplinary collaboration. Such relationships can enhance the rural psychologist's work. Teamwork can assist the rural practitioner to develop more effective services and enhance what it is that they're doing. Personally, I really enjoy working with social workers and nurses. They give very, very different kind of perspectives on things that I do. Finally, the unique nature of rural psychological practice, that increasing need of and use of technology for communication and the wealth of alternative education delivery models actually might mean enhanced opportunities for professional development and support. And many of the people I interviewed saw those kind of advances as opportunities to build community among rural colleagues. Also, there's the rewards of working for social justice, which is more frequently being considered in Canadian psychology, in part due to people like our own Sandra Collins. Rural Canadians do experience poorer socioeconomic conditions and have less favorable health status than their urban counterparts. Recent research has indicated that rural and northern practitioners are more likely to participate in social advocacy for their communities, and that there's really a need for such advocacy for the economically disadvantaged, which unfortunately means many of Canada's rural peoples. So particularly as a university, if we shift that to sort of looking at some of those implications for practice-based education, we need to focus on the idea that practice-based professional learning focuses on the relationship between the theories and other forms of professional knowledge with training and professional development for an applied field. Practice-based education in post-secondary settings enhances the training that graduates receive, socializes them into the norms of communities of practice, and prepares them for workplace realities. That helps them develop their professional responsibility. Psychologists in particular are scientist practitioners, and we represent a profession that's meant to bridge research and application in continually evolving environments. As such, practice-based education in psychology fosters lifelong learning, facilitating evidence-based practice. This study had several benefits for practice-based education. The descriptions of actual practices provided by participants bridge a gap between research and professional practice. The socio-historical considerations allowed for a fuller and more robust understanding of the kinds of pressures right now in professional practice. Also, the results of the study add to the knowledge field and foster recommendations for training and practice. Generally, this research supported the need for a greater understanding of rural practice and professional ethics in that context. There's a need for rural-specific practice models, training, supports, and ethics guidelines. Canadian psychologists in rural practice may be particularly vulnerable to government and societal pressures, and to registration and mobility issues. Some of the adaptations of professional practice norms, namely telephone services, travel-related issues, how you plan around blizzards and storms, and even atypical service settings where people have offices and meet, those things weren't even in the available literature. Further, those real benefits of rural practice are very rarely explored. Even when the underlying issues might have been consistent with international literature on practice, the excerpts and stories shared by participants in this study represent Canadian accounts Some situations may well be quintessentially Canadian, and as such, useful for training and development of Canadian psychologists. Participants in the study shared the kinds of adaptations they made and began to speak how and why they chose those strategies. That may not always represent the best ethical decisions, but they're actually really useful accounts of actual practice. Finally, the study had implications for studying professional ethics. In this dissertation, I found it difficult to study ethical reflexivity, which had been one of my main goals. And that could be because of the abstract nature of ethics, my research skills, or maybe reflexivity isn't even required to demonstrate wisdom and good practice. The ethical development of the participants in the study was impacted by rural-specific critical incidents, which generally speaking means when we make a really big oops and then go, aha, this is what I should have done. And those kinds of experiences could really serve to inform training and practice. The results of the study began to reveal underlying schema used by participants for their ethical decision making. That included a real commitment to ethical practice, an awareness of ethical issues, the role of critical incidents in developmental fine-tuning of ethical decision-making, and there was a real central theme around boundary setting and consultation. Exploring professional ethics in rural Canadian psychology through the experiences of practicing psychologists was an opportunity for an in-depth interpretive examination of this issue. Hermeneutic phenomenological research methods used with a relatively large number of participants fostered a comprehensive understanding, but there are limitations to having chosen this path. In this study, I was not a passive observer. I could not present an objective reality of the findings. I am a rural practicing psychologist. Generally speaking, the experiences of others cannot be fully understood. In attempting to simplify and articulate complex processes, the results end up really representing an artificial way of knowing. As qualitative research, this study is bound to the situational context, which does limit the interpretations. An interesting part of researcher bias, I had to forewarn all participants that for certain ethical transgressions, I would need to report them. Now, I would think that might have limited their openness in some areas that we were discussing. And the final area, too, I had primary responsibility for this study. So that always means reduced objectivity. If there were other researchers involved, there might have been other methodology and interpretations. The results of this research create a foundation for future study. This study provided impetus for research to define rural professional practice in psychology. it's an area I'm doing some work in. I look forward to certainly more work. If we had a really adequate definition, that could not only capture those diverse characteristics of rurality, but could do a lot more to foster research, funding appropriate programs, and really provide a shared understanding of what is rural. The study also supported the need to develop protocols, specifically for adaptations to professional practice norms. Those adaptations aren't in the literature, and replicating it with different groups could really start to tease out what works well and what could actually create more difficulties in the long run. So once again, I want to thank everyone for making some time in your day, hoping to have sparked some interest or insight or discussion. So I would really look forward to hearing any ideas you might want to share.
Go ahead, Terry.
Hi, Judy. Thanks for that. I'm wondering whether there was much interest amongst the participants or even in yourself in sort of using the new technology, especially the interactive ones, video conferencing, Skyping, even Second Life or whatever, to sort of meet some of the challenges of isolation and traveling to get, because I imagine that people, even if they're a rural practitioner, there's probably a lot of traveling, even by you, or at least by others, having to travel to you, because all rural people don't live in the same town as you might happen to be. So, was there much of it, or is there a sense that psychology practice has to be face-to-face?
Sorry, kind of two aspects of that. The one was that professional development and support, because in the literature it really says this is a huge problem. And when you ask people, they say it's very expensive to travel. Most of us budget days and money just for travel and hotels, et cetera. On the other hand, even though participants agreed with that, most of them said, I do a lot by telehealth now. I do a lot of, you know, I don't have to consult with people in my province or my region. I've got people that I consult with that are in Nova Scotia and BC when we have similar issues. And there's been just huge advances. And I think that's where there's probably been a big change in the last 10 years. In psychology, there's starting to be a bit more infrastructure for that, where I find there are some problems and we're falling down is with client services. Psychology is still really sort of jumpy about even using telephone services, and do we really know that's the client on the other end? And we are far behind what clients and people are actually doing and wanting, and we worry a lot about the implications. In my own experience, I find Australia is quite a ways ahead and is using a lot more technology for services. I have a percentage of people who travel 150 kilometers one way to see me, and so I get a lot of cancellations in the winter when the roads are bad, and that's not ethically providing good services. So it's a really interesting area, and I'd actually like to unpack a bit more some of that use of technology to bridge concerns and services.
Why isn't it acceptable to do your sessions over the phone? Like, do you ever do your sessions over the phone?
I do some. The issues are not so much doing them over the phone with psychologists. It's a lot of how can you guarantee that that is the client on the other end of the phone or the email or Skype. How can you assure their privacy and confidentiality, that those lines aren't somehow being accessed or tapped into? And it's those unknowns that create difficulties. When I provide services by telephone and some online, I usually have had sort of a longer standing relationship, and I know that person well and they know me well, and we can chat about some of those kinds of issues. I use a BlackBerry. The encryption is very, very good. I still don't actually know how secure things are on their end, so it's really about the privacy and the confidentiality issues.
Well, if the client is okay with doing it over the phone or doing it by video conference, say through Gmail or any of those things, if they're okay with it and know what the risks are, why can't, you know, I can't see any reason why it can't be done that way. I mean, here at AU, we have to do all our counseling like that. We have no other choice.
Yeah, I agree with you, Julia. And actually, I think the Canadian Counseling and Psychotherapy Association is a little bit better. But the Canadian Psychological Association is still hoping they can avoid these issues and just sort of give people large warnings and then go away. Mm. If I relate that a little to rural practice, as psychologists, our standards say we will not have overlapping relationships. Well, you cannot live and work in a rural area and not have them. So there is a bit of a split sometimes between the reality of actual practices and professionally what we're saying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was a college counselor, I'd be in picking up groceries. I was laughing at one of the ones you had up there. My husband and I would pick up groceries, and I'd have a student come up to me and talking about her eating disorder and everything there in the grocery store. My husband's standing there, and I'm like, listen, come see me Monday morning. This is not the time or place for this. And I used to have it happen a lot. You know, people would come up to me, could be in the video store, and I'd start hearing their life story. So it's just part of it. I don't have to worry about that here, though.
We have a question online from Kathy. How many of the participants were originally rural dwellers, and how many were originally from cities, and do you think this influenced their responses?
Kathy, you should have consulted with me earlier when I was selecting participants. That really was a big issue, and I think that's something that future research would want to tease out, because I did have about half were urban individuals who were in rural practice or had been in urban and then were in rural, and half that were rural, sort of more or less born and raised, or, you know, 20 years plus experience. And I started to see some differences, but it was sort of beyond the scope of what I could do. They seemed to have on a superficial level, a lot more comfort at how to handle overlapping relationships, how to deal with community pressure, because they weren't really working in a foreign context or culture, even if they were working in a different community. But I didn't sort of unpack some of that, and it wasn't one of the premises of the study, but it make great future study.
Yeah, thanks, Judy, for that presentation. Really interesting and visually really, really pretty. I'm intrigued by the notion of the overlapping relationships. In this situation, obviously, someone would come into your practice and you have witnessed firsthand their behaviors, you've witnessed firsthand their level of activities in their neighborhood and their environment because you're a part of that, and you've heard a ton of stuff, and it's just all around, and somehow I imagine you have to work to keep that at bay, to focus on the person and their story and the perception of their story at hand. At least this is my idea of it, and I don't know if you can say something about the actual strategies or some of the complexities of trying to deal with that intermeshed situation.
That's part of that psychology's urbanization, I think. And one of the complaints from other professions is that psychology is really individuated. We look at the individual person and their perception of reality, and we want to help them. And to that extent, sometimes we're not that effective either. Because part of working with someone is helping them put together the pieces of their own puzzle. And often as practitioners, the more pieces we have, the easier it is for us to also work with them. So if I sort of try and make that more clear, we know from the research we're more effective as soon as it's a couple or a family and not just an individual, because you're getting those different kinds of perspectives. So for me, I'm often fairly honest and upfront. I know that my own perceptions can be biased and I can pay attention to only certain things. So I will put some of that aside and really try and get into their shoes and see things from their perspective. I'll also point out when I may know or have an awareness of things. And I think clients would be surprised if I didn't, or if I didn't say, you know, I think some community perception is that your marriage has been in disarray, et cetera, even if they're telling me something different. Because it's often very public knowledge, and I'd rather own that and sort of be upfront and invite them to challenge me or give me more information. The stories that the participants told in my near 700 pages of transcripts were fascinating, fascinating. Some of the experiences they'd had, the difficulties, how they juggled those, and how sometimes they actually learned wonderful things from them.
Go ahead, Mark has a question online.
Hi, thanks, Judy. It was an excellent presentation, interesting and very worthwhile. I had a comment and a question. The comment first harkens back to, I think, the issue that was brought up previously in terms of why psychologists aren't into doing more with technology. A part of that, I think, might be that it would be hard to prove competency in that until there are training programs that include that, or some avenues for getting some supervision so that you know that distance counseling that you're providing is actually competent counseling. So that's a barrier, I believe, that the training institutions and the profession needs to address. And second, the question is, do you think that rurality should be thought of as a cultural issue?
Thanks, Mark. You know what? I really like your comments about training institutions, because I think we have tremendous potential here at AU that we don't tap and use. How many psychologists, counselors, people in the mental health field, allied health, we're lifelong learners, and we do a lot of training. And, you know, some of it's better than others. Universities are really well positioned to be offering some of that, and for practitioners in the field to be involved in also some of that curriculum, et cetera. We're bound by the national organizations. We're bound by government approval of programs, which sometimes is behind actual practices. But for practice-based education, I think that's an area where we can really be contributing. I don't know, I read a lot of the literature, I edit some of the articles in the one journal, and there aren't many articles even about that, but you go to a conference presentation and the room is packed when you're talking about online, telephone, because people are very curious and they want to start to share that. So I'll just put all that responsibility on your shoulders as a psychologist, Mark. Surely you can be doing some course development. Question two. Sometimes I use the expression rural culture, and then I started switching over to rural context. So good catch. I think it's probably more appropriate to say rural context, because there's multiple cultures within each rural community, and of course they really vary across the country. But it's sort of a way to capture the idea that we need to be aware of the context and culture in which we practice. And I do think rural is distinct in many ways, and I think you can argue with me on that, and some people have, but I'm actually more convinced of that now that I've done the research than I was before.
Judy, at the beginning of your presentation, you mentioned that it was thought that there were more mental problems, more mental illness in rural areas, and then you left that. Towards the end of the presentation, you talked about socioeconomic dynamics, rural versus urban, but could you comment statistically or anecdotally or in any way on a prevalence of mental issues in rural locations?
Yeah, that's a really beautifully messy area that I enjoy. Now, a lot of the stats around mental health considerations come from health. And many people do seek services through health, so they're diagnosed and coded under depression or anxiety medically, and that's where we get some of those stats. Some are some self-report from Stats Canada. And then the literature sort of falls down where it doesn't understand that. Is there a higher prevalence rate and what does it really mean? And so there's lots of literature that speaks to the stigma of accessing services in rural communities, and how that's why people may end up in their lawyer's office seeking litigation or in their doctor's office seeking medication rather than seeking other services or even acknowledging that it's a mental health concern. A lot of that literature, though, is not empirically supported. And there's also a smattering out there that really talks about the infrastructure of communities. Maybe people in rural areas may be more open with their doctor and may not even want or need to access services. So how do you actually tease out what's going on and why? But it's just looking at stats and Statistics Canada, the medical reporting, and then also information from the Romano Commission that did a little bit more to try and unpack those things. They really saw more issues and need for services in rural areas and very poor training and support and infrastructure. One sort of related point to that is that in Australia, part of their national strategy is that if you're from a rural and remote community, they make as much education available as possible to you at a distance. They have distance and rural regional providers. When they don't, they pay you to travel to urban centers to train. Here we have little to none of that, so people move to urban centers and tend to stay there or don't see it as an option. It's just very difficult and expensive to go and train. Now that said, Australia has only 12% of their population that's rural and remote, and they're not that big of a country. And we have 20% of our population, and there's just very little infrastructure and support. It's kind of a related point. That's your question?
Any other questions online? Okay, I see there's no other questions in the room or online, so we would like to thank Judy for her presentation today. Thank you, Judy.